Welcome back to the Extra Innings Podcast. Yes, it's been a while. I feel like one of those network TV shows that goes on hiatus for like 3 months. I'm Ryan Divish, Mariners beat writer here at the Seattle Times, your host of this podcast that was supposed to be weekly that is now taking like, I don't know, a month and a half off. My apologies for that. I had hoped to kind of maybe get a little bit different equipment in terms of, so it would have a little bit better quality, a little more mobile, maybe actually take it to Safeco Field or someplace where I could get players on, talk to them instead of me always calling Larry. But it hasn't worked out. But still, I got to be a little bit more consistent with it. So I'm going to try to do that. That's my goal for the second half of the season, is to try and record a little bit more of these. Because there has certainly been stuff to discuss. You know, there was the injury to Drew Smyly, all those kinds of things along the way, some losing streaks, some winning streaks, stuff we could have discussed, and it really just kind of went by the wayside. So my apologies. I promise to be better about it going forward. As far as this week's podcast, I talked with Larry already. I'm in Chicago. It's late Wednesday evening, I guess, or early Thursday morning, but I talked to Larry for about an hour. So I won't sit here and talk about this, but we discussed the All-Star game a little bit, Seattle getting the All-Star game, some of the news that came out of there, the first half of the season, our thoughts on that, and then the column he wrote on Felix Hernandez in the King's Court. So I won't take up any more of your time, me rambling, and we'll get to the interview with Larry Stone. All right, we're on the phone with Larry Stone. He's at his palatial estate in Bellevue, I'm sure. He had his butler deliver his slippers and everything else and punch in his code for Skype so he can remember. Larry, how you doing?
I'm doing good. In this case, my butler is my son. I handed him the phone and said, get Skype for me so I can do this thing.
Well, he knows. I mean, what are you going to do when he leaves for school next year?
I'll probably drive up and
have him do it
on podcast nights.
Okay.
Do his laundry and in exchange for having him hook me up.
And give him money as well, I'm sure.
Exactly.
I guess first we'll just start a little bit with the All-Star game. You know, it doesn't count anymore, which I think is a good thing. And it seemed to be kind of fun. Any thoughts on the Cano homer or anything like that, or Cruz taking a selfie or taking a pic with Joe West?
I do think that without the game counting for the World Series home field advantage, I think it definitely loosened up the players a little. I think it gave them the freedom to have some fun, and I think that was conveyed. I've seen a lot of positive feedback from that. You know, I think the one, you know, it was kind of a boring game, let's be honest, other than Cano's homer and a couple of good defensive plays. I think people will remember just like Tommy Lasorda getting knocked over in the third base coaching box at Safeco Field. They'll remember Nelson Cruz's selfie with the umpire, Joe West, in 10 years. That's probably what people will remember more than anything.
Yeah, I mean, other than that, I mean, you know, when you have – well, when your local guys – because you've covered the All-Star game before. When your local guys, one – take a photo with Joe West, and then two, hit the game-winning homer. There was a lot of rewriting that was going on there at the end. There were some curse words, because I was even thinking that maybe Michael Conforto or Jake Lamb, two local kids, might have gotten the hit because they had a chance in the ninth, and I kind of looked at Bill Shaken from the LA Times like, you know, I like the kids, but this could really screw up my game story. So instead, Cano did it instead.
Well, it reminds me of the one year, I think I've told you this story, but way, way back, Century 21 had a promotion where everyone in the Home Run Derby played for a contestant, and whoever won the Home Run Derby, if their contestant won a brand new house, and I was like done for the night and was kicking back and enjoying the Home Run Derby, and the person who won was playing for someone in Seattle
who won a
brand new home. So there I was like at 11 o'clock and debating whether I needed to write this or not. And I ended up going down and doing a story on the person from Seattle who had won a new house. And so, yeah. You know, so when you least expect it, sometimes you have a story dropped in your lap. You know, the Ichiro, when Ichiro was the MVP in San Francisco with the inside the park home run, that at least happened early, so I was prepared for it and built my story around that. But when it happens in the last inning, I felt for you. I, you know, readers don't quite understand what that entails with the deadline and not much time and having to redo your story. But on the other hand, you know, that's what we're there for. And sure it was exhilarating in the end when sometimes those are the most fun when you're scrambling and running on adrenaline to beat the clock and get the story in.
The good thing was is like, and you know how pure hell it can be with so many people there covering the game.
Oh yeah.
Like I got to Cruz's locker early. And so, and he came out and he's great to talk to. And so I was able to talk to Cruz quickly right after the game. And then, you know, they had a press conference with Cano. So I was able to get in there and it worked out pretty good. I mean, you know, it is a logistically kind of a difficult thing, but I don't know. Did you cover the tie game and then 2000? Was it?
Oh yeah. It was in Milwaukee, 2002.
Yeah.
That was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. You could just sort of see that thing developing, that they were running out of players. And what made it so poignant in a way and laughable in another way is that it was in Milwaukee, you know, Bud Selig's town. He owned the Brewers for all those years. He had been pushing for this, you know, this All-Star game was going to be a shining moment in his town. And then in the 12th inning or whatever it was, when they ran out of players, there was that picture of him just with his hands above his head, like, what just happened? What are we going to do now? Just in total disbelief. And that was the impetus for the, you know, making the game count. Baseball was thoroughly embarrassed by that. It was just terrible. And there was a Mariner pitcher who was it? Freddie Garcia, I think.
Yeah, who was the chief.
Yeah, who let in the runs that let the game tie, you know, be tied, I think, or something. He had some involvement. I can't remember now. It's all a little hazy. But, you know, Bob Brenly was the National League manager, and I remember that, and Joe Torre, and they both allowed themselves to run out of pitchers. And, and then I think baseball overreacted a little bit to try to make the All-Star game relevant again. And all that did, I think, was make people mock it. It was just kind of silly to have something as important as home field advantage decided by an exhibition game like, you know, maybe a player for the Minnesota Twins in a year when they're in last place gets a hit, and that's going to determine who's in the world, you know, who gets home field advantage. And, you know, before that, it was alternate years, and you know, I always wondered why it wasn't the team with a better record. But you know, Katie Feeney, the who sadly died earlier this year, but she was in charge of the scheduling, and she always said there was just too much of a logistical hassle to not know which team was going to be, you know, you didn't know which team was going to host the World Series until the very end if you did it that way, because the ALC, depending on the way the LCSs went, it mm-hmm. could go different ways, and there was hotels and flights and all that thing. But that's the way they're doing it now, so obviously they've figured out a way to work it out so that the team with a better record is going to be the home field advantage, and I think that's the way it should be.
Quickly, we can discuss a little bit. I know I sent you the audio of Rob Manfred talking to the BBWA writers. I don't know how much you listened. One of the things he mentioned was talking about the All-Star game and the three bids. He's going to announce three bids. So next year it's in Washington, D.C. at Nats Park. The year after that it's in Cleveland at Progressive Field. And then the next three are up for bids. And the way he made it sound now, though, and I wrote a little something on it, was talking about the infrastructure of the game, having a convention center to run Fan Fest nearby, having transportation, all the things. I mean, this was a disaster in Florida here, but they wanted certain things. It sounds, you know, before where I think he just gave, you know, a lot of teams just got the All-Star game. You build a new stadium, you get the All-Star game.
I think Manfred makes it sound like they want to be courted a little bit, that they want, you have to put a bid together, you have to wow them. What can you do for baseball? So I'm curious about that. I know Seattle, and talking with some sources, has put together another bid. I think they're realistic in thinking that they might not get it in these next three. But, you know, just kind of, where do you think, how do you think this is going to work out? I mean, obviously we believe SunTrust Park in Atlanta will get one of those three because it's brand new. But who do you think could be the other candidates?
Well, it's interesting. The era of, I mean, there were so many new stadiums built there in like a 20-year period, and that was part of the impetus. They, you know, you get the new stadium, you get the All-Star game, you know, eventually, and they've all had their turn, including Seattle in 2 years after their new stadium opened. You know, in 2001, they had it. Yeah, it does seem a little quick to be back in Seattle from 2001, but there's been, you know, there's been some instances where teams did get a second game that quickly. I think Dodger Stadium is going to be very high on the list. They have not had an All-Star game for an incredibly long time. You know, I actually went to the last All-Star game at Dodger Stadium.
1980.
I had just graduated from college.
Oh my God, I was five years old.
You were 5 years old. I was a grown man. And
someday I hope to be one of those.
Now I'm still a grown man, and you still have no. Never mind. Yeah. So I sat in the stands with my parents and some friends from college, and so that's what 37 years ago.
Yeah.
It's high time that Dodger Stadium got it. You know, the new Atlanta Stadium. I can't remember if there's any other of the new ballparks that haven't had it.
No, none of the newer parks, they've all had it now, other than SunTrust.
Yeah,
but
think Wrigley Field is another one that they've talked about.
Yeah,
I covered the last one that was at Wrigley Field, but that was we're talking a long time ago. I think I was still working at the San Francisco Examiner, so that's, you know, I've been here 21 years now, so that's at least 21 years. So you know, you can't go wrong having one at Wrigley Field.
Yeah, I mean, I think too with all the changes and amenities that they've tried to do at Wrigley, you know, and part of it was is the Players Association and MLB had complained about the visitors' locker room, the visitors' clubhouse, and.
Yeah,
in Wrigley, which is roughly the size of about a $2,000 Seattle apartment right now. But I think that they're going to change that within the next year or two, and then that MLB might reward them. You know, and you know, like they did all the stadium work. The one thing is if you kind of look at it, you know, there are just going to be certain stadiums that aren't going to get it. It's like, not like it's going to go to Oakland. You know, or and some of these other newer stadiums. So Seattle could be in that rotation. I don't know that they'll be in the next three, but I think maybe in the next couple after that, they definitely have a chance. The one thing is, and it is interesting, you know, you have to go and you know, you work with the city on this. You're putting a bid together with the city, the Chamber of Commerce, all this stuff. Seattle is so rich as a city right now, and the hotels and things like that. I don't know that they need it per se. You know, I mean, it would be a huge boost for local businesses, but they're already booming. And you know as well as I do, when Major League Baseball comes in for the All-Star game, they take up like three or four big hotels and they set rates. I mean, if you've looked at the rates for hotels in the local area, they're not cheap. And they probably wouldn't like that. I mean, they could probably stand to make just as much money not having it. So I'm curious to see how that works. Because of that, but if from an infrastructure standpoint, and from like kind of the markets, and because they haven't had an AL team, they've only had one AL team over the last 6 or 7 years, I think they want to push to get at least another American League team back into the mix as well.
Well, one thing that Seattle definitely has going for it is that the last one they did in 2001, they pulled off, you know, just flawlessly. I've always felt that was the pinnacle of baseball in Seattle. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the weather was unbelievable. The stadium was sparkling new. You know, everyone was still proud of showing it off. The team was on its way to the best record in American League history. And at that, you know, you went into the All-Star break thinking this was a World Series team. The Mariners had eight players, and you know, Lou Piniella was one of the coaches. I mean, everything about that 3 days, the week really was just magical. Mm-hmm. And you know, I had so much fun covering it. I think were you there yet? Or
no, I was. I did my internship in 2000 and then left for a while.
Okay.
Sounds like a lot of work to me, but you know,
it's actually less work. You know, I've covered about 15 All-Star games, and you know as well as I do that it's the one of the hardest working events for a sports writer. That Monday is, you know, sports writers call it the longest day of the season because, you know, you're working from sunup to sundown. But, you know, you're always solo. But when it's at home, we had the whole staff out there. So I did less work in that one at home than I did at any other All-Star game. I, you know, just had my one story or maybe two stories rather than four or five. Yeah. So that even that aspect of it was fun. And then you had Ichiro batting against Randy Johnson and Cal Ripken's last game and Gwynn's last game. And it was just, you know, everything about it, I just remember with great fondness.
Well, you might not get as much help as you had in past years based on staffing numbers.
Yeah.
No, that's cool. I mean, you know, it'd be cool. I think Safeco's. I was talking with some writers about it, and they would love to have it at Safeco. I mean, you know, for people that don't know, that's the favorite road trip for most American League baseball writers is come to Seattle. Because we were kind of joking in the Miami humidity. One of the guys from, I think, L.A. looked at me and said, well, what's the humidity like in Seattle right now? I go, what humidity? We don't have that.
Yeah.
It's just they love coming here. So, I mean, you know, I don't think they're going to get it. You know, I think it's, you know, prescient for the Mariners to make a bid now, you know, put that in the mind of Major League Baseball. And maybe they get rewarded, maybe not in the next 3 years, but down the road. That would be interesting. See, you know, another thing is they have a new ownership group and maybe that's something. Maybe Rob Manfred wants to, you know, throw him a bone after, you know, blowing up Drew Smiley's elbow in the WBC. I don't know.
I listened to that.
He didn't like my question very much.
No, he bristled a little bit, yeah. But it was a fair. It was definitely a fair question. But you know, the commissioners use that as leverage for things. You know, it's mm-hmm. just like. You know, like all politicians, and that's what the commissioner is to a certain extent. You know, for reward for backing him in something, or incentive, or you know, whatever. You know, beyond. You know, they're obviously looking for a place where they can have a good game. That's, you know, with the infrastructure that you talked about, but it's also a way to. It's a coup that the commissioner can use. Judiciously and you know, for various reasons, in inducement to get a new stadium or to help you in negotiations or whatever. So that's another factor, who he owes a favor to or who owes him a favor.
Yeah, no, it's all a different scene. Yeah, you would, I mean, you couldn't, I'm sure you can, but the amount of media surrounding Aaron Judge on a day-to-day basis was unreal. It was just unreal. Even like the Japanese reporters and the Latin American reporters, they were all there. I mean, it was just every day, you know, and the TV people were all over him as well. It was interesting. Somebody joked that the All-Star game won't be in the state of Florida anytime soon unless the Rays build a stadium. They ain't going to Tropicana Field. So it was cool. I'm looking forward to D.C., a little bit more than Miami. I like D.C. as a city better. Miami had some struggles. And then, you know, of course, I had to endure Flo Rida and Pitbull on back-to-back days on live concerts.
We were all feeling for you. We all said our condolences.
Yeah, right. You were loving. That was Schadenfreude. You're loving my pain. All right. Well, let's go. We'll go to the first half. I wrote a story. We're recording this on Wednesday night. I'm in Chicago. I wrote a story today. I spent an hour and a half on the tarmac in a traffic jam after we landed in Chicago, which is amazing. But I wrote a story just kind of looking back at the first half, basically what we do for the midway point. And, well, I guess it's not really the midway point, but the metaphorical halfway point of the season. You do kind of one story looking back and one story looking ahead. before the All-Star break, we talked with Jerry DePoto for about 25 minutes. Jerry talked for most of the 25, and we just kind of got his thoughts on the season, the first half, and everything. You know, what they kind of quoted was he talked about how disappointed he was, and you know how they've underachieved this year. What did you think of what he had to say to us?
Well, I thought he was pretty blunt. You know, using the underachieved thing. You know, he made it pretty clear that they are not going to throw in the towel. That they still think they have a shot at, you know, at this thing. And they do. They're, you know, for all the struggles that they had, we keep saying this over and over again, but four games to make up is one hot streak, one win 10 out of 12 or something like that. And, you know, I continue to believe that they have that potential in them. And I thought it was interesting when he was listing off all the strengths that this team has. You know, he was talking about, you know, Haniger, and you know, he went around the lineup virtually and told how great each person was. And I was thinking as he was doing this that with all that being true, why are they four games under 500? And yeah, it really does come down to the pitching, which was a mess. And you know, it could still be a mess if some things aren't fixed and some things don't go right. So that's what I'm looking for in the second half, is to see how that staff comes together and to see if he does make a move. You know, I think he's almost got to go get a bullpen guy and, you know, probably a starter, one more starter, because
they need another starter. I think, you know, they have to have a starter and a bullpen guy as well. But
yeah, that's going to be hard to get, though. I mean, do you want to get just a number five journeyman-type starter who might not be any better than what you have? You know, you want to have someone better than that. I mean, Andrew Moore gives them hope of being better probably than a lot of guys you can get on the market. But, you know, he is young, and there probably are some pitch innings limits with him. You know, I think he's probably going to be okay for to ride out the season, but it could get dicey at the end. And then I don't know if Gavilio, you know, maybe the magic is over with Gavilio. We'll have to see. He did, you know, great work for them. But yeah, I think going into a stretch drive where you want to make the playoffs, I think you want somebody more established than Sam Gavilio.
This is true. So, yeah, I wrote, you know, I kind of wrote in my story, and I don't know if you were at that. Were you at that Friday night game against the Astros where they beat him like 13-3?
Yeah, I was there.
And I watched it on TV. I was in Montana. I watched it on TV. But I remember kind of watching that game, and my dad said, man, that place looks like it's rocking tonight. Like, it just, he said, you know, that looks like a good crowd. And I go, well, you know, they've won six in a row. They're playing the Astros. And I just kind of remember looking at Twitter and talking to a couple people, how excited everybody was after that game. I mean, what did you think at that point that night? I mean, they'd won seven in a row. They were 37-35 at that time. And you kind of thought, okay, here, this is where they're going to go and kind of just stay kind of above 500.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that pulled them within one game of the wild card, too. I mean, I certainly thought that, you know, here we go. They're going to be in the thick of things. They found their groove. Felix was back. Paxton was back. Haniger was back. You know, they have their team, and then it just fell apart from that point on. They lost out on the rest of the homestand. Then they won two out of three with the Angels, and then they came back and lost. How many to start the next homestand? No. Three or four.
Yeah. So they since that night, and I think also Calkins wrote that they were a playoff team that night based on
the kiss of death.
Yeah. Good job, Matt. I think since then I have them going 6-12.
Yeah. I mean, that it was, you know, that it was really devastating, not just for the standings and for the team, but I think for the fan base, which was just, you know, this fan base.
Oh, yeah.
They want to believe the worst in this team. And they have a right to, because it usually is the worst. And, all your optimism is usually dashed, and your hopes are usually torn apart and all that. But, you know, this was one of those times when fans were starting to buy in and stuff. And then it was just, once again, you know, torn away from them. And I think each time that happens, it makes them increasingly more bitter.
And yeah, so it makes them less likely to come back. I know that.
Less likely to come back and certainly to believe. So not only did you, you know, lose your momentum, fall back in the race, but you just gave the doubters more ammunition to just not believe in this team, to be pessimistic and cynical and all that other stuff. And, you know, we can't blame them.
6-12. I mean, even if, you know, that's 18 games, even if they went 9-9, it's just, it would change their fortune so much more. And you know, they have, I want to say, and I'm getting nauseous thinking about it, but I think of their next 40-some games on the road, 27 of them, or next 40 games out of the break, 27 of them are on the road, including August, where they're home 7 days. You know, and there's a bunch of games against the Yankees, the Red Sox, good teams. I mean, they kind of really squandered an opportunity there before this.
Yeah, because there were games at home. There were two against the Phillies and three against the A's, or was it four against the A's?
Four against the A's.
Yeah, I mean, that's six games against last place teams that they went 2-4 against. You know, you just can't have that when you know that the brutal part of your schedule is still ahead of you. But I mean, look, it's just amazing that 500 is all. I mean, is a great jumping off point this year for the wild card. If you're 500, you're right there. And you know what you just said about all they needed to do was go, you know, this 9-9 or whatever, 500. If they had done that, they'd be one game out or something like that of the wild card instead of four games out. So, you know, that's not a real high bar to get to 500 and stay there or get above. And I still think this team has a run in them, and I still think that they're going to be a factor before it's over.
Yeah, I mean, they've done it. They, you know, people say, "Well, why would you think that?" Well, they've done it like three times this year. You know, they went 6-1 on a stretch after on one of those opening homestands, and then after going 1-7, where they only scored like one run every game and got shut out twice at Fenway, they went 9-1. I mean, that's, you know, they're capable of kind of going hot streaks like that. But it's pitching. Here's some numbers that are just, I think, crazy. One, they've used 14 different pitchers to make a start this season, including four rookies that have never started a game before, ever. Not exactly ideal. Of their 90 starts this year, of their 90 outings for the starters, Mariners pitchers have thrown seven complete innings or more just 18 times. Ariel Miranda's done it seven. And the rest, that's 11 for the rest. They've had 36 outings of five innings or less. And they've had 30 games where the starters allowed at least four runs or more. I mean, that's just, you know, they have a four. It's just, you can't win like that.
No, and that's conversely what gives me the basis for some moderate optimism is that, you know, that disrupted rotation should stabilize. You got Paxton and Felix, provided they stay healthy. You know, they both showed signs in their last start that maybe they've turned a corner. Just, you know, imagine those guys doing what you kind of expected and hoped for going into the season, giving you seven good innings a night with Miranda, the numbers that you mentioned, and more. You know, you don't want to count on a raw rookie like him, but he's gone six or seven, even eight. Didn't he go eight one start? Yeah. You know, every time out. So, and then if you could somehow pick up a guy and stabilize that fifth spot, and if you can start getting more distance from the starters, that's the domino effect is it's going to help the bullpen, which, you know, their problems in the first half, I think, were predicated upon being overused because of all that flux in the rotation and you know, having guys up from the minors who were only giving you five, and then you had to extend the bullpen, and, you know, and as one big factor that DePoto mentioned in that conversation we had with him was that bullpen usage cost them a bench spot most of the first half, and that was huge. You know, having a 13-man pitching staff meant that you only have a three-man bench. Is that right? Is that what they went with?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for a lot of the year, and that limits your pinch hitting, and your, you know, guys are playing too much. Seager probably overused again. So, you know, if you can start fixing those problems, you know, if the rotation settles down, everything else improves, at least in theory.
I thought it was interesting. We were talking with Scott Servais that one day, and he kind of just mentioned, you know, we just have to go out and score 5-6 runs every night. And I think,
yeah.
I'm thinking to myself, that is not a way to live. I mean, and essentially, because of the way this team is, I think it wears on the offense. Now, they won't say that, but when you walk out onto a field and before the game starts and you basically believe you're going to give the opposing team's going to get at least 3 runs against you, that's hard to play, because if you don't score in the first couple innings, then you start to see some stuff. You know, they start pressing a little bit, trying to do more. I thought, this number is really telling. The Mariners are 40-15 when they score at least 4 runs in a game, and they are 3-32, including 0-25 in the last 25 games, when they score 3 runs or less.
Wow.
I mean, they're just not winning a pitcher's duel ever.
No, and you're right. You know, we both kind of looked at each other when he said that, because you just can't count on that. You know, they've got a lot of veterans in their lineup, but they also have a lot of kids who are still really. I mean, Haniger and Gamel and Heredia have yet to have a full major league season under their belt. So, and you know, they're the outfield on a lot of nights. You know, Zunino is still a young player finding himself. So, you know, maybe those guys are you know, when things start going bad and they know they need those runs, maybe they start pressing. You know, Haniger certainly hit the skids there at the end, or, you know, really after he came back from his injury, he hasn't been the same player. You know, Zunino had the hot month, and then July he's been, you know, frighteningly like Zunino of old, and they need a little more of that consistency from him. But, you know, as DePoto, I think his words to us in that conversation were, our offense is not our problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, it may be unfair to count on 5 or 6 runs a night, but, you know, they're certainly, they're averaging about 5, I think. So, you know, if you get 5, you should be able to win most nights.
Yeah. Well, and he even said, I mean, here's the quote, we're not good enough and we are too flawed to expect one element of our team to carry everybody. And he goes, and that makes us, you know, like he pointed out, that makes us like 12 other teams in the American League, because they are, right. They're all flawed, other than Houston and maybe Boston. But yeah, I think it wears on the team mentally when your pitching is that bad. I mean, and it's no different than the reversal of a few years ago, when pitchers knew that if they gave up more than 2 runs in a game, they would lose that game. I mean, you know, when the offense was so bad, you know, 5-6 years ago, and they struggled to score 3 runs a game, I think it wore on the pitchers because they knew they were never going to get any run support. They just, you know, they haven't put together kind of a consistent stretch. I mean, injuries are a part of it. I am curious to see whether he goes out and gets another arm. I think he basically said he was going to add to the pitching staff. He didn't kind of elaborate how he's going to have to be creative. The one thing is like, they don't have a lot of prospects, and you can't go and trade Kyle Lewis, probably Nick Neidert, for a guy that you don't really like. You know, I mean, if you're going to get a guy, DePoto's not going rental. He's going to get a guy that's going to be here next year, because you know what? They're going to have the same pitching problems next year. So the one thing that they do have in their favor is Hisashi Wakuma is not going to be back next season. His option is not going to vest. That's $14 million. You don't have to pay him. Drew Smyly, I can't see them bringing him back at $6.5 million or whatever it would be, when you know that he might only pitch a month, month and a half. And that's if he gets back. I mean, he's not a quick healer, and that's a 12-month recovery, 12 to 15-month recovery. So, I mean, that's 20-some million dollars coming off your book that was almost expected payroll in a lot of ways that they'll have some flexibility with. And, you know, I know that I do think that they will add payroll to pick up a guy, but it seems to me that's the only way they can do that.
Yeah, well, the one thing they do have, Ryan, is, you know, thinking about this, you know, they don't have many chips, but suddenly they have this surplus of outfielders. Yes. I mean, you have three young guys in Heredia, Gamble, and Haniger that you can really count on moving forward. And then in the minors, you have O'Neill, Powell, Leonis Martin, and Kyle Lewis. You know, they're not going to trade Kyle Lewis, but, you know, realistically, you got to think that Tyler O'Neill could be in play, because where's the spot for him? You know, if you like those other guys, you know, maybe his power makes him more appealing, but you know, he could be a trade chip if you want to get a guy who is not a rental player, maybe has a little bit of a contract that you're willing to pick up. You know, that's just something to contemplate.
Oh yeah, no, I think he's available. I think Kyle Lewis would be the main guy, and maybe Nick Nieder. I don't know. I mean, the Mariners don't have any power arms in their minor league system as starters. You know, they don't have that. You know, they don't have. I don't want to use Syndergaard because that's not fair. But you don't have, you know, a futures game power arm coming up. Nick Nieder's a nice player. I mean, throws 93, 94 maybe. But, you know, he's not quite there yet. But, yeah, I think, yeah, O'Neill will be fine. They could push Nieder. Lewis isn't going anywhere. I mean, I guess.
Sierra.
Yeah. I mean, they could use him. I mean, they could trade one of they could trade one of the kids off the big league roster if they really – I mean, if it was a better talent, they might have to look at moving one of those guys. I don't think that they'll move Gamble or Haniger, but they could move Heredia. I mean, he doesn't play a ton. You know, they've used him a little differently. Yeah. I mean, you know, what you really want to make those trades work, especially at the deadline, is some guys, because teams want talent that's near major league ready, and they don't have that per se at AAA, like in big talent. You know, like they don't have the, you know, if DJ Peterson was a better player, he would be the ideal candidate. But I mean, he just really hasn't, you know, he doesn't have that kind of desire. I mean, there's a reason why the Mariners don't have a ton of prospects in the top 150 in baseball. But I think they'll make a move. He's very creative. It'll probably be a three-team move to kind of access, you know, different things. But I just don't think you can go forward with what you have. I mean, I don't even know that Sam Gavilio is going to stay in the rotation. I think Gallardo could be back in the rotation by the second half.
And, you know, it's July 12th. I think a lot will be determined by what happens in the next 2 weeks. You know, 14 days it brings you right up to the trade deadline. If they go in the tank, you know, you have another stretch like they just had, and suddenly are 10 games under 500 and 8 games out of the wild card, you know, trailing 8 teams, then you're not quite as aggressive, obviously. Then the whole thinking changes. So, I mean, we're assuming that they hang in that sort of nebulous area where they're close, but, you know, not too close, or they make a little run. But if they fall back, you know, then everything changes. Then you got to reassess. And that's what's happening all across baseball these last 2 weeks. There's so many teams that are particularly in the American League, every single team is within 6 or 7 games, and they all can fool themselves into thinking they're one hot stretch away. But if that doesn't happen in the next 2 weeks, then you really have to, you know, have a talk with yourself and be honest about whether this is a team that could do it. And you know, the Mariners might be in that same boat. They're in a different, they have a different dynamic in that they are desperate to win and make the playoffs, and I think they're going to be more reluctant than other teams to say, not wait till next year, this just isn't our year. I don't think they're going to make that determination unless things really, really fall apart.
Yeah, because last year, you know, they were kind of in the same spot by the trade deadline, and you know, then they got hot again. You know, they weren't really, I don't know, I can't remember exactly what it was. I don't think they were, like, legitimately... You know, I think there were 4 or 5 out of the wild card at that point.
Yeah,
and then they
were 500, I think. But yeah. I'm talking about 10 games under.
Oh yeah, no,
you know,
no,
because
I
mean they're 4 games under now. I mean, it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility that they fall 10 games out. I mean, that's one of the scenarios that could happen.
Oh yeah, a very real scenario.
Yeah, but if it's, I think anything short of that, and they're gonna. they're going to proceed as if they have a shot, and they in this American League, you know, they do.
Yeah, and if they are 10 games out, you know, you'll see them try and move Dyson, Valencia, Zepchinski, Cishek, you know,
Gallardo,
try and move those guys so they and maybe get some of that like talent, you know, and maybe that's a time where they do use those guys or something to pick up buy a contract or something or do something that way. I mean, you get creative because I do think you can get some guys cheaper at the trade deadline than maybe in the off season, you know, and maybe you could do something there, you know, not just in terms of it would help you this year, but next year, because like we said, they have pitching issues next year if they don't add to this team.
Well, Jerry has shown a propensity for picking up, you know, the hidden jewel, you know, the Wade Miley trade deadline deal last year. You know, who would have thought that Wade Miley would get you anything that would help you? And, you know, he got you Miranda, who's now your most consistent pitcher this year. So, you know, and then a totally under the radar deal that everyone pretty much yawned over, got him Ben Gamel last year, late in the season. Yeah, you know, that sort of thing. So if you can pull off a couple more of those, maybe you can pick up some pieces that will help you next year, and we won't even know it until next year.
All right, well, we'll wrap it up with this. You wrote the Felix column talking about no more chanting of KKKK, and it was more about the idea of Felix needing to change his approach to attacking hitters as well. I know we've talked about this on numerous occasions, but you know, anything that came from that and talking with the Mariners and stuff like that.
Well, first of all, we kind of joked earlier that Calkins wrote that column that they were going to make the playoffs, and then they proceeded to lose, you know, like seven in a row at home. As soon as I wrote the Felix is not the overpowering pitcher anymore, you know, I told myself I almost guaranteed that he was going to go out and throw a gem and be his old overpowering self, and sure enough, that's what happened. So I don't know if you know, I'm not pompous enough to think that my column affected him, but something, you know, that was the vintage Felix there. But yeah, you know, there's people in that organization that agree with me. I'll just leave it at that.
Oh yeah.
The K, you know, they love the King's Court. They love Felix. They love the fans' involvement. But just at a time when they're trying to convince Felix to be that he has to change and change his mindset and change his persona and all that, and not, you know, not try to be that overpowering guy, to have fans screaming KKK, you know, just sort of subconsciously they fear gets in his head and sort of hurts their, you know, their ability to get through to him. So it just seems to me at this stage of, you know, it was great for 2011 Felix and perfect game Felix and Cy Young Felix and 240 strikeout Felix and all that, but now he's a different pitcher. So, you know, I don't think anything will change this year. We'll see what happens next year, if they have a little maybe change in the King's Court and decide that it, you know, that it needs a little tweaking. I'm not sure what they would do without the K's. You know, as I joked in the column, you can't chant weak grounder to short, weak grounder to short. No. That just doesn't have the same ring to it. But why not just, you know, dress up in your Felix garb and your robes and all that and just cheer for outs, maybe not put up the K card. But apparently no one listened to me because that Sunday that the column appeared, they were chanting and waving just like always. So
yeah,
I guess I don't have that power.
They did it out of spite. They did it out of spite. You know.
Yeah. I heard from a few people who didn't like it, but that's what this job brings you.
Look, the bigger aspect of it though, of the purpose of the column wasn't about the King's Court as much as about the guy needs to change.
Right.
You and I have I've covered him since 2006, and you have covered him much longer. He's stubborn at times. Mm-hmm. He's stubborn and he's ornery, and that's what has helped make him great, that stubbornness, that he believes he's better than everyone else. The problem is it's not working the way he wants to do it now. So he's going to have to change his thinking, and they've asked him to do that. I think Sunday's start, and I watched it while I was at the Futures game. I had it on. I watched it very carefully. I thought that was the outlier in this because he had perfect command of his changeup and his curveball. I mean, his fastball was just okay, but his changeup was so good and his curveball was so good, and he could throw them basically wherever he wanted, that, you know, that's why he got the strikeouts. It wasn't because, you know, I mean, he had stuff, but I mean, how often is he going to have, you know, that pinpoint location? Because, hell, if he'd had command like this, and we've talked about this, it's never been about the velocity. Everybody's so worried about the velocity, even Iron Glenn. It's always been about command, putting the baseball where he wants it to. He hasn't had that consistently for two seasons. So, I mean, I don't know. Like, I know that I talked with Nelson Cruz and Cano about it. They were really excited and felt like Felix turned the corner. That's fine. But is he going to continue that mentality of being able to attack hitters differently? He almost pitched kind of backwards in that game a little bit and do that. I don't know. I mean, what do you think? Do you think he's going to change? I don't think he's going to change instantly overnight.
No, but it's not. I mean, it hasn't been instant. It's been, they've been drumming this into him.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it's not like it just started. This has been an ongoing theme. You wrote a very excellent story about it last year this time.
Off season, I think, is when I wrote it about them.
Okay. Drilling. I thought you wrote one during the season too. You wrote the definitive one. That's right. It was in the off season, right when Service kind of challenged him at the end of the year about how he needed to get in better shape and change his mindset and all that. But so it's not like it really isn't like they're expecting him to do it overnight. This should be a work in progress where he's had time to assimilate all that stuff. But, you know, outings like Sunday maybe make him think that, I don't have to change because I still got it. I don't know if that was a result of the changes or a result of him sort of having a summonings the old Felix for a last hurrah kind of thing. You know, you talk to Stottlemyre, you talk to DePoto, you talk to Service, they all say the same thing. He's got more than enough stuff to be a very good, excellent pitcher. And he certainly showed that. Whatever the reason, if he can maintain that and be a semblance of that, that's going to be a huge thing for the Mariners moving forward, because they need Felix. He's a huge part of whatever hope they have for making a run here. You know, you get Paxton and Felix as a 1-2 punch that they envisioned all along, and you finally get it rolling. That changes everything. Suddenly Miranda could be a number three and not have the pressure of having to be the most consistent guy, and Moore can just kind of slip in as a rookie and, you know, whoever turns out to be the number five guy. So, they need Felix. Whatever Felix they're getting, they need him to be good like he was Sunday.
Yeah, no, I thought he was. I thought he got ahead of hitters a lot better than he has. You know, one thing about velocity, we'll say his changeup was right around 85 to 86, which is definitely, you know, and his fastball is right about 91, 92, 91, pretty consistently. That's a bigger separation than it's been. You know, there was a time where Felix was throwing his fastball his changeup 89 miles an hour, and PitchFX couldn't pick up the difference between that and his fastball. They've kind of talked to him about wanting to get a little separation within the velocity, and they felt like if he does throw it slower, it might have more sink. It's not necessarily the violent sink that he has on it, but it still has good sink. So I thought that was important. But I mean, really, you know, he didn't nibble like he did because he didn't have to. Everything was going the way he wanted it to. And like people were kind of talking about, I mean, I saw kind of one comment about, oh, I guess it's not about being in shape. No, the reason they wanted him to get in shape was they felt like he wasn't physically strong enough and in shape enough to continually repeat his goofy delivery. And then his delivery would fall apart mechanically and he would lose command. They felt that if he got stronger in the core and legs area, and a little more flexible, he would be able to repeat his delivery more consistently. And that's been the issue as well with his mechanics and the command. It's all that he doesn't, it's not as, when you get older, athletic things are hard to do when you get older, says the guy with a torn oblique. All right. And I'm not in any way comparing myself to a professional pitcher, but you know, we've talked to Nelson Cruz and Robinson Cano and all these other guys about how much more difficult it is to play this game as you get older. They've adjusted. It's been taken Felix longer to mentally and physically adjust to what age has done to him and his body.
Yeah, and, you know, he came to camp, Iron Glenn, who continues to get a lot of publicity from you and me in these podcasts.
Well, it's because we're afraid of him.
Yeah, exactly. He whipped him into shape, and he came to camp in pretty good shape, and everyone was pleased, but, you know, that's kind of fallen by the wayside.
Yeah, that muscle isn't there anymore. It's been reapportioned to other parts of his body.
Yeah, which, I mean, that's something the Bears watching in the second half. If what you said holds true, then that could, you know, that's not a good sign. But, you know, he's certainly not out of shape, I wouldn't say. He's just not as, you know, not as fit as he was when he came to camp and he wanted to get ready for the World Baseball Classic and all that. And, I mean, that's a whole nother thing that we haven't really discussed lately, but you know, I wrote that column about how the World Baseball Classic kind of messed up the Mariners' season. You know, the four pitchers who were in it all had problems. You know, cause and effect. Who knows? I think it certainly was in Smiley's case. I mean, there's no question about it. You know, Felix, Diaz, and Gallardo. It's a little harder to pinpoint, but all of them have been disappointments, and two of them were hurt, and two of them just underperformed. So that's another thing.
Yeah, no, you know, Rob Manfred disagrees with us, but I'm sorry, that's an issue, you know, and it's going to be an issue. And I'm curious to see how many teams aren't afraid of this a little bit. Look, the Latin American players are going to play. It's very important to them. But I, you know, James Paxton's agent did not want him to play in this, and he didn't. And I think he probably made the wise decision in the long run.
And he still got hurt, which Manfred would point out. He still got hurt. You know, who knows what would happen if he'd pitched. You know, if you recall, it was a smashing success, I think, artistically. And a lot of players like Mike Trout came away afterwards and felt like, man, that was so much fun on TV. I want to be a part of it. Guys who, you know, I think the takeaway was that more guys wanted to participate next time. I think in 4 years, no one will remember that Drew Smiley blew out his arm. They'll just want to, you know, they'll just want to go out there. And the commissioner has a vested interest in this thing. This is his baby. Well, I mean, it was Bud Selig's baby, but now it's Manfred's baby.
They made more. It was funny. It was somebody sent me an email saying, well, some of that money should go to the Mariners since they lost out on their investment. But I mean, but yeah, the ticket sales were at an all-time high. Ratings were at an all-time high. They were dramatic games. You know, it was a great showcase for baseball in a time where they're trying to get more fans, but.
And it's also, I mean, it's part of their outreach program. They want to market the game to Europe. They want to market the game to, you know, Australia and certainly to Latin America, which is already a hotbed, but they want to keep that. So, you know, they have a lot of reasons. Manfred is not going to acknowledge any deficiencies in the World Baseball Classic. You know, that doesn't mean that behind the scenes they might not, you know, they've to their credit, they've done things to try and protect the arms because teams, you know, every team is wary of that. And there's pitch limits and there's innings limits. And, you know, the managers and general managers work very closely with the pitching coaches and the managers of the players that they get. And so, but it's just the fact of life that you're not ready to throw in high adrenaline competitive games on March 15th. I mean, Drew Smiley was averaging 93, a guy who only averages 90. I mean, he was pumped up to win this game against pitching against Felix, and a must-win game against Venezuela. And that was the last game he ever pitched in a Mariners uniform. So, you know, I just think or he wasn't even in a Mariners uniform. He was in a USA uniform, but that was the last game he pitched this year. And you know, you could do all the safeguards you want, but what you can't do is take away the competitive juices.
No, it's an issue. I'm looking at the Mariners midseason notes, which I tweeted out today for people. You should, if you're a geek about numbers and stuff, they do an amazing job of compiling all this stuff. I was looking at the transactions. This is amazing. Since the opening day roster, since setting the opening day roster, Seattle has made 122 transactions involving the 40-man roster in 97 days. That means they're averaging a transaction every 19 hours and 5 minutes. The longest stretch this season that they went was out without a roster move was 6 days, wow. April 15th through April 20th. And then in a 15-day span in May 9th through May 23rd, they made 32 roster moves, including 2 moves per day from May 13th to May 17th.
Wow. Even Pete Carroll and John Schneider are saying, slow down, guys.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of notebooks right there. You know,
that's a gift for you. You knew every day that your notebook lead was going to be some transaction. You know, I just wonder how disruptive that was, though. Certainly it was disruptive to the Rainiers, but you know, the all those times when a guy would throw 3 or 4 innings in relief and know that his reward for pitching well was going back down to the minors and bring up a fresh arm. You know, all that shuttling in and out, I don't think it was good for the morale of those players on the yo-yo, and it was tough for the major league team and for service to have to juggle all that too. It's just, you know, it was necessity from the injuries and everything. And they did a lot of machinations to make it all work, but that's not the way you want to run things in an ideal world, and they know that.
Yeah, part of another number. Seattle had 16 placements on the disabled list, including 7 players on the DL at the conclusion of the first half. 3 players missed the entire first half: O'Malley, Simmons, and Smiley, obviously. And they had 4 members that are expected rotation miss time. So 3 starters: Segura, Cano, Haniger, Segura twice. In all, the club has lost 735 player games to the disabled list in the first half of the season. Wow. 19 different players were placed on the DL, a club record.
Jeez, and that's only at the All-Star break. They need to be a lot healthier in the second half, particularly with the pitching. I mean, that goes without saying, and it's pretty obvious, but it's vital. I mean, again, it was just it was too disruptive in the long run, and I think probably the biggest reason why they were 4 games under 500 in the first half.
All right, we've been going for a long time since I had a, you know, we haven't done this in a while, so I will let you go. I promise we won't go in a long break like we did the last time, the hiatus. I kind of was waiting because I thought we were going to get some different gear, and then it took me, you know, Larry's still trying to remember the password, which I had to reset up for him. So, no, we'll do this again.
I sure hope the audio turns out and we don't have to do this this over again. I might just quit.
If this doesn't turn out again, that will be the end of the – if this doesn't work, that will be the end of the Extra Innings podcast as we know it, until, like, they get us a recording studio or something.
All right. Well, cross your fingers when you hit playback, and we'll see what happens. All right. Well, enjoy Chicago. I mean, the bars stay open till like, 5 in the morning, so it's, like, midnight now. So I think you could just get started. Go out to the lodge.
You know, the bar stayed open in Miami till 5 a.m. too, so I'm going to take a little one-day hiatus from that.
Yeah, that's smart, because you've got the weekend. Yeah. You got Friday, Saturday in Chicago. You want to pace yourself.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
All right, take care.
Hey, thanks for listening to this week's Extra Innings podcast. As I said, hopefully we'll be a little bit more regular with these things and maybe we won't have to go an hour-long conversation as well. Big thanks, as always, to the house band of the X-Trainings podcast, Midnight Salvage Company out of Tacoma, for providing the bumper music leading in and out of this. If you guys need to get a hold of me in any way about the coverage, the podcast, whatever, ranting about the Mariners, feel free to email me at rdivish at gmail, or at Seattle Times, not Gmail, rdivish at seattletimes.com, and always hit me up on Twitter, at Ryan Divish. And I also have a professional Facebook page that you can follow, and I do kind of try and check in on that as well. Again, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you later.